for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The banking crisis in Cyprus has drawn attention to the cryptic world of international tax havens. Here in this studio to look at how they work and why they're used, James Henry. He's author of a Tax Justice Network report titled The Price of Offshore Revisited, and Richard Rahn of the Cato Institute. He's chairman of the Institute for Global Economic Growth. Joining us from the NPR studio in New York, Lee Shepard, a contributing editor at the journal Tax Notes. I'm sure many of you would like to join in. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Hi.
Good to have you with us. James, I'll start with you. Will the banks in Cyprus be open tomorrow?
Well, that's what they're promising, but right now they have a lot of work to do, so we're not quite sure. Under the requirements of the EU deal, in order to get the $13 billion of aid from the EU for bailing out the remaining banks, they have to close some banks. They also have implemented, trying to implement capital controls and design a way of protecting against the remaining deposits leaving. And, you know, they're also struggling with an economy that suddenly waked up to find out, you know, it was heavily dependent on a very dodgy set of banks. So, you know, this is a big problem for the tiny Cyprus government, and they're struggling to solve all these problems at
so
once.
So what does the IMF, the EU deal mean for the future of Cyprus as a tax haven?
I think Cypriots are waking up to find out what many of us in the United States already know, is that if you have a dodgy banking system and it has basically been unregulated, it affects everybody in the economy. So they've got their work cut out for them to design basically a new model for their economy. They have gas reserves they've just discovered off the coast. That may lead to what we call a resource curse. But right now they're suffering from the finance curse, which is to have this outsized, very dodgy banking system. And so I think many people in the short run are going to be losing their jobs in the banking system. There's about 25,000 Cypriots out of the population of 860,000 that work in banks. And so many of them are going to be trying to find new employment. That's the important thing for them.
And to you, Richard, how unique is Cyprus in this whole area of offshore tax havens?
Well, Cyprus is quite unique. Each one of these, the offshore centers, has a different product line. They do different things. Some are very well managed, like Cayman. Switzerland, of course, is the gold standard of banking soundness. And then you have others, like we've seen here in Cyprus, which were the banks, the two big banks, bought themselves many Greek bonds, which, of course, are worth now a fraction of what they previously were. And so people who were depositors, and for a lot of Russians who were depositors in these banks, are going to suffer some loss.
How much loss?
Well, it could be up to 40%. We don't know precisely yet.
Now, has that deal included a level above which funds would be withdrawn?
It appears that the people who have less than 100,000, which should be probably most of the local citizens, will not really be hit by this. But for people who had very large accounts, and I think that is probably primarily a Russian population, will get hit.
Why did Cyprus fail? Was it simply because of investing in places like Greece with bad bonds?
Yes. I mean, you had banks that were not well managed and not prudently managed. And a prudently managed bank does not expose itself to inordinate risk by particularly buying government bonds, which are not sound. Part of the trouble, though, goes back to what we call the Basel Accord. There's in the Bank for International Settlements is in Basel, and they set sort of the world standards. And if you have sovereign government bonds on your balance sheet, you normally don't have to hold reserves against them under the myth that government debt will always be paid. Of course, we know that's not true.
So what do governments like Cyprus do with the money that gets deposited? They, as you've said, invest in some good, some not so good, or risky investments, but they don't have to hold reserves equivalent to that which they've invested.
Remember, it was private banks. It wasn't the government of Cyprus. It was the private banks.
Right.
And without knowing exact details there, they probably did not hold much in the way of reserves against these government bonds because, according to international standards, they wouldn't really have to. That was a major mistake. And if they'd been a bit more astute and had been reading the stuff that I expect both James and I have written over the years, they wouldn't have done that.
All right, and turning to you, Lee Shepherd, what makes a particular country attractive as a tax haven to either an individual or a corporation?
For individuals, you need bank secrecy. For a corporation, you need a network of treaties so the corporations can get the money in and out of the country. Because the difference between the way corporations use havens and the way individuals use havens is individuals store money there. Corporations do not. Corporations, you basically wash money through there so they can take it out of the country, usually a developed country, where they earned it, and then get it back to another developed country to either pay it as dividends to their shareholders or use it in some other business venture in some other country. Cyprus is kind of funny. It's got a little of both. It's got a lot of treaties, but then it's got a lot of things to offer individuals, too.
But in offering these special things to individuals or to corporations, is the primary reason for these tax havens to avoid or completely evade taxes, Lee?
Well, it's the primary purpose of the users, yes. Now, but what you have to think about here is, when individuals do it, we are frequently talking about behavior that their home country wouldn't like, even if it's not criminal, okay? When corporations do it, like big American corporations, which don't use Cyprus so much, they use other havens, when big corporations do it, they have to have domestic laws and laws of the countries they do business in and treaties all helping them out to do it because their accountants won't sign off on it if it isn't legal. So the point is tax havens don't act all by themselves. There have to be laws in place that let the corporations use them.
I want to clarify something.
Sure.
Here.
Go ahead.
The International Financial Centers, they serve many different purposes for many different clients. And a lot of it is regulatory efficiency, having very little or nothing to do with taxes. For instance, Cayman has the great majority of hedge funds registered in Cayman. That has to do with regulatory efficiency, and its main competition are some U.S. states like Vermont and South Carolina, Delaware, and other places. And also, Cayman has a lot of what we call captive insurance. Captive insurance is where a company or an industry association owns their own insurance companies. Bermuda has the bulk of the insurance. But those have to do with certain regulatory structures, much more so than taxes.
I think we can't really let that go unchallenged.
May I talk?
Hold on, Lee. Go ahead, James.
I mean, the Cayman Islands has you know, basically specialized in undermining other countries' laws on a whole host of fronts. He mentioned hedge funds. You know, we've had the Axion problem. Bear Stearns was an example of a Cayman Islands registered hedge fund. There are hedge funds based in the Cayman Islands that allow local directors on the boards of hedge funds to the tune of several hundred companies per director. And so that's one of the reasons they like the Cayman Islands for hedge funds is because of these lax regulations.
That's not true.
We have Enron. We have a long list of examples of Cayman Island, not only mutual funds and hedge funds, but also you know, individual banks where the regulatory mining and the tax evasion is phenomenal. So Cayman is not an exception to the Cyprus.
No, I just fully disagree with that.
Okay. Please, Richard Lee, go right ahead.
Yes. Okay, look, none of the regulatory arbitrage with the banking laws, with the insurance laws, with the securities laws, I shouldn't be hitting the desk here, none of this regulatory arbitrage is possible without the tolerance of the home governments of these, you know, insurance companies, hedge funds, what have you, and the protection of either the United States government or the British government. And the admission of these countries into the bank clearing system, which is protected by the developed country governments.
Lee Shepherd, she is a contributing editor at the journal Tax Notes. And we're going to take a short break here. When we come back, we'll talk about this issue of secrecy and whose secrets are being kept from whom and where all this tax money is going. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking about the current state of tax havens around the world. We have been reading specifically of late about Cyprus, and it has served as a tax haven for many wealthy individuals and corporations, primarily in the case of Cyprus, the Russians. Here with me, James Henry. He's an economist, an attorney, an investigative journalist, and author of the Tax Justice Network's report, The Price of Offshore Revisited. Richard Rahn is senior fellow at the Cato Institute. He served from 2002 through 2008 on the Cayman Islands Monetary Authority, which regulates the world's largest offshore financial center. And at the NPR Bureau in New York, Lee Shepherd. She's a contributing editor at the journal Tax Notes. And we're going to open the phone shortly, but do give us a call, 800-433-8850. Richard, Ron, I know you want to get in on the last part of that conversation.
The problems that Bear Stearns and others had nothing to do with their Cayman-registered funds. Their problems were mistakes they made and To the extent there was any illegality, that was all under New York law. They're New York companies or U.S. companies. In terms of directors, very large hedge funds have well-paid independent directors. But most hedge funds are tiny organizations. And so what you have are basically corporate directors, companies that serve as directors for these. So you may have a list of a lot of individual names, or I mean one name, a lot of different funds, but it's actually a corporate entity which is serving as the director and enables them to have efficiencies of with their own experts to review all these, where no one individual could possibly do this, and for the small fee they get, a couple thousand dollars, couldn't spend the time actually looking at this because these are things that are too small.
All right, James, you've estimated that the total wealth in tax havens is somewhere between $21 and $35 trillion in 2010. First, how did you come up with those numbers?
Well, this is like estimating the size of a black hole, Diane. I think, you know, there's no direct estimates, but what we used were three different methods. We looked at outflows from developing countries and did detailed models of those. We also looked at the Bank for International Settlements data on cross-border deposits and tried to estimate how large the portfolios associated with those were. And then we also, as another check, just looked individually at the top 50 private banks involved in helping wealthy people move their money offshore and hide it from tax authorities. And those 50 banks alone, including the largest banks in the world, had a total of about $12 trillion just among those 50 in assets under management, cross-border deposits, and unmanaged brokerage assets. So that gave us confidence in the larger number.
I'd be fascinated to know about corporations and individuals in this country who use offshore tax shelters and whether there have been any estimates as to exactly how much in the way of taxes this country loses because of those offshore.
Well, there are two different categories of behavior. As Lee noted, corporations are engaged in moving intellectual property and other assets offshore. There's an article today in the Washington Post about that. We estimate there that the losses per year in terms of tax revenue to the U.S. Treasury are on the order of $90 billion. And then on the individual side, where you have wealthy Americans parking their money in Switzerland, like as we had in the UBS case, you know, that's on the order of $100 billion a year, the IRS estimates. So, you know, this is a substantial amount of money. We're talking about a sequestration project right now to cut the federal budget deficit by, you know, $85 billion in terms of federal spending. So I think ordinary taxpayers are increasingly upset about the fact that the wealthiest companies and individuals on the planet are able to use these dodgy havens, of which Cyprus is only one of 60 to 70, you know, and one of the smallest. On the Tax Justice Network Secrecy Jurisdiction Index, they're number 20. You know, you have Switzerland, you have the UK, Luxembourg, Cayman Islands, Bermuda, all of these are much bigger players in this essentially, you know, sort of parasitic industry that's undermining the rule of law.
Richard Rahn.
Well, parasitic industry is a highly emotive term for actually doing the best allocation of capital to its highest and best use around the world. One of the problems we have is the U.S. corporate tax rate is the highest in the world at 35%. The nonpartisan tax foundation just estimated that the revenue maximizing tax rate for the U.S. government for corporations would be about 15%. Canada has a 15% corporate rate. So the U.S. is highly non-competitive. For U.S. corporations to compete around the world, they keep a lot of their overseas earnings offshore. The ideal world would be for us to reduce our corporate tax rate to that of to be competitive. Then this money would flow back in.
Let me inject a question there, which I'm sure is on the minds of many of our listeners, which is, if this is truly a burden for corporations, that is this 35% tax rate, why is it that corporations are taking in such huge profits?
If I could respond to that, I mean, corporations in the United States had their best quarter ever in history in the fourth quarter of 2012. They don't pay 35%. The actual effective rate is much lower. As the article in the Post said today, you know, most major companies on the Dow 30, for example, are paying close to 0% tax rates. General Electric in 2010 had a zero tax rate because they're using these offshore games to move intellectual property, brands, software, you know, other lines of business to low tax havens, paying themselves royalties to Bermuda, where they have no real business, and essentially saving hundreds of billions of dollars in taxes.
Lee Shepherd, want to come in?
Yes. Like I was saying before, you can't just use the tax havens like Jim Henry is talking about there by yourself if you're a big corporation. You have to have the U.S. law on your side. We have a bunch of rules, chief among which is the one called the check-the-box rule, that enable those U.S. companies to run money through the tax havens and to park intellectual property offshore and pay themselves royalties without paying immediate tax on it to the United States. You don't need to get technical about it here, but it's in the last 20 years, because of some of our rule changes, chief among which was this check-the-box thing, it's gotten very easy to do this, to zero out, especially if you have intellectual property that you can move. It's very easy to have a zero tax rate all over the world. Then when you want to bring the money back to the United States to pay dividends to your shareholders, you're going to have to pay the full 35%, okay? Now, if you want to reinvest the money in the United States, there's other ways to get it back to the United States without paying that full 35%. So when they're complaining about the 35%, it is a dividend question. It is not, oh, I wanted to build a factory here question.
Well, I disagree with some of that. But the more fundamental question is, who owns corporations? When people talk about the terrible, greedy corporations, most big corporations are largely owned by pension funds. I expect the NPR pension fund has investments in GE or Exxon or a lot of these others. Most people do. These owned by a lot of individual shareholders who have saved the money for retirement or for college tuitions. And so we somehow think there's some big one greedy rich person out there. It owns all these things. There are a few of those, but not very many. Most companies are owned very widely and primarily by, again, pension investment funds, college endowments, and so forth. So those who want to increase taxes on them really want to go ahead and diminish the rate of return for college endowments, for people's pension funds, and make them poorer. The corporation income tax, most good tax economists will say, is one of the worst taxes of all times. What you want to do is tax what people take out of an economy, not what they put in.
All right. I don't want to have this divert into a discussion of whether we ought to lower the corporate taxes. I want to understand how these tax havens get created, what the rules are, and how they're used.
Diane,
who's using them?
Could I respond to Lee's point here? I think she's absolutely right that these tax havens don't do this alone. There's a global industry.
Of course.
But those regulations she's talking about that were relaxed in the Clinton years, like check the box and other technicalities.
What does check the box actually mean?
It means you can make income that you pay yourself disappear from your U.S. tax return.
That's pretty simple, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty simple.
But the idea is that
says you can treat the entity that pays it and the entity that receives it is non-existent.
Non-existent.
The income doesn't show up on the U.S. tax return, but you can make it show up places where you want it to show up. Like if you want it to show up as a deduction in Europe, you can do that.
Okay.
But it makes it very easy.
How does an individual put his or her money offshore? How does
an individual goes and gets a bank account. And what the U.S. scandal was about was that the UBS scandal, but there's other banks that were doing things like this too. What they were accused of doing was sending the bankers to the United States to get people, okay? Because in the old days, it was hard. You had to get on a plane and fly to Switzerland and meet with the guys and see if they would take you on
right.
as a client.
Right.
When they started, you know, shopping in the United States and making it easy for people, that got to be a mess. But it's actually fairly easy for people to set up some of those bank
accounts. And is there a minimum amount, James, that people have to have?
I mean, the global private banking industry loves it if you have more than $5 million, but there's only about 10 million target clients in the offshore industry that are worth anything like that. So it's a fairly tiny group. 0.14% of the world's population owns all of these offshore assets.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Lee, at what point does financial confidentiality stop and secrecy actually begin?
They're both names for the same thing, but I think what you're talking about, I guess, is distinguishing clients who come in with criminally gotten funds and clients who come in with legal funds. I mean, there really are two types of clients for these things. There's your basic crooks and your politically exposed persons who may have got bribes and things. And then there's your sort of bog standard well-off person who earned the income legally in their home country, paid tax on it there, and wants to stick it in a haven somewhere so they can either not pay taxes on the income or not pay alimony to their ex-wife or, you know, something like that.
All right, Richard Ron.
First of all, there is full information sharing with most of the large offshore centers like Cayman with the U.S. government, with the British government. You would be a fool to set up a bank account in a place like Cayman and not report the interest earnings, the income.
So you're saying
I need
nobody
to talk.
Has...
No, I need to talk.
I've been involved in this, and I know that information sharing errors, there's the tax information agreements.
It's totally above board.
But that's not true. There's no automatic information exchange.
There is information exchanging on request, and it's following the rule of law. If there's a suspicion that any one of us has an account elsewhere, it goes through the normal judicial process in both countries. And if you talk to the people at Treasury and the IRS, they have no problems with places
all
like
right,
payment.
Okay. James.
Well, the information request process that he's describing is an arduous one that requires you to practically know the person has evaded taxes before you ask for that information. What we really need to have is an automatic information exchange like we have with Canada. But, you know, most
explain what's going on with Canada.
Can I talk?
Hold on.
Lee, do you want to jump in here?
Yes.
All right.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay.
What goes on with Canada?
What goes on with Canada is we automatically exchange bank account interest information. Who's Canadian, who's getting interest from a bank account in the United States. Okay, now, what goes on with these tax information sharing agreements is they are treaties, okay? And they are, as James is saying, very difficult to use because the mechanism is that you have to know absolutely everything about this person and their account. And what you're really doing is you're going to the haven for confirmation that they own the account. You only do that in a heavily well-developed criminal case. So what's going on is that mechanism is not helpful in my more common standard case where I have a person with legal sourced income that's been previously taxed who is just hiding it. It's really not very useful there. It's also not useful up front, which is where you want the information. You want to know before you start cases and before you start chasing people around who's got deposits elsewhere. Now, they're supposed to be reporting that, if they're Americans, they're supposed to be reporting that on their own tax returns, but we've had quite a scandal in the last few years that they haven't been doing that.
Leigh Shepherd, she's contributing editor at the journal Tax Notes. Richard Ron is with the Cato Institute. James Henry is author of the Tax Justice Network's report, The Price of Offshore Revisited. When we come back, it's time to open the phones. Remember, we're not just talking about Cyprus.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, dedicated to educating wonks to use knowledge to change the world. More at american.edu/wonk. By the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence at thescanfoundation.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
Edna O'Brien's early work was banned when first published in 1960s Ireland. For this month's Reader's Review, her novel, The Lonely Girl. It traces the sexual awakening of two young Irish women. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we've just had a news report from Geneva. The AP is reporting that Swiss media say that U.S. prosecutors are poised to step up their probes of wealthy U.S. tax evaders using the tiny principality of Liechtenstein, which I gather, James, Switzerland, supposedly the gold standard of tax havens, is now going to be looked at a little more closely.
Well, we've been looking at Switzerland closely. We've had several big scandals with banks like UBS and HSBC, the second largest bank based in London, but with a big Geneva office. Last year, a whistleblower released the names reportedly gave the names of 120,000 offshore clients of HSBC. The U.S. Treasury is also investigating 13 Swiss banks that were involved in calling on wealthy Americans. So, you know, this activity, I think, is exploding in terms of investigative attention. What we need to do, I think, is to generalize it just from the U.S. Treasury trying to prevent U.S. taxpayers from taking their money out to, you know, all of the wealthy Brazilians and Latin Americans, people from developing countries. That's where it's really hurting this industry. About $9 trillion of our $21 trillion is from developing countries, and they can't afford to have their wealthiest people moving their capital offshore beyond the reach of taxation.
Richard Brandt.
Well, with a lot of these countries, they violate human rights all the time. Let's say like Venezuela. Venezuelans, a lot of them have put money into U.S. banks in Florida and elsewhere. And if you go to these automatic information exchanges and start providing these basically corrupt and criminal governments with this kind of information, we're going to have major problems. Now, the Swiss, they have a different system. What they do is do tax withholding and remit it back to the governments in order to keep their financial privacy. That's their law. They are a sovereign state. They have a right to do the way they want to. Now, we have these huge number of American accounts. Well, most of these accounts, the people do pay the tax required on it. They do report
to the U.S. government.
To the U.S. government, yes. There are many reasons you'd want a Swiss bank account and or an offshore account. One is the kind of returns you get. Right now in this country, you open a bank account, you get less than 1% on your money. Inflation's more than 2%. We have capital expropriation by the U.S. government. It's an unlegislated tax. So people seek higher returns. They want to protect their money against inflation, and that's one reason they go elsewhere.
All right, I'm going to open the phones first to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Gary. You're on the air.
Good morning. I happen to be a Canadian who's lived in Dallas for 30 years. I have a Canadian credit card, and recently, just because my family members, some of them live in Canada still, I wanted to open up a Canadian bank account with Canadian funds and do it remotely without having to go back to Canada. I was told, even though I have a Canadian passport, valid, I cannot do that. Of course, I have a social insurance number as well. I cannot do that unless I am physically present in the country and show proper ID. And that should tell you a whole lot about what is going on in the rest of the world compared to the Canadian relationship with Canada and transparency.
All right. Thanks for your call. Lee, I gather that's rarely a requirement for other offshore havens.
That is the way it used to be. And, you know, that's up to Canada and their banking laws that they're doing that. But lately, you know, in order to get a smaller customer who needs access to their money, you have to give it to them remotely, and you have to give them a credit card attached to the account. A few years ago, we had in the United States with Americans banking in the islands, we had a whole amnesty for people who had credit cards attached to island bank accounts, and they weren't big hitters. Hmm. You know, this was sort of a...
I have a question for Lee. I don't know any place where you can do that any longer. I know it's almost impossible for an American to get a bank account in Cayman if they don't live there.
Yes.
The days of getting off cruise ships and opening a bank account and getting a credit card, they've been gone for many years.
Okay, I want to
That is being cleaned up.
Okay.
We're just trying to contrast what Canada's doing to this guy,
right,
and how easy it was, you know, previously to do this.
Lee,
stuff.
Can you talk briefly about the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act and
yes,
how far it will go to addressing the problems of tax havens?
What it is about, it is about making foreign banks and other foreign financial intermediaries, but for our purposes, we're mostly talking banks, report U.S. clients to the United States government or to their own governments
under
special agreements.
I see.
Okay. Now, what Richard Ron is saying is becoming increasingly the case that foreign banks are refusing to do business with people with American passports because they regard this reporting as a great big pain. The problem is for them. They are going to have to do this reporting if they have investments in the United States, which a lot of them do because a lot of them are managing money for people all over the world. Also, the other thing that has happened with FATCA, which is very interesting and none of us expected, is that other developed country governments, like the European governments, have said, oh, well, gee, we like this idea. We'll sign on to that because proportionally, they have a much bigger problem of individual tax cheating than the United States does.
Interesting. Are there, in the United States, states that are considered tax havens? And can someone living in another state use that state as a banking depositor?
Well, we now have 13.
Yes and no.
Okay, James.
Okay.
We now have 13 states that have developed asset protection trusts that are on the same model as the Cook Islands.
So what does that mean? Explain that.
Well, asset protection trust is a fancy way of saying we can set up a trust to hold your assets.
To hold or hide?
Well, they come to being the same thing in practice.
That's
in any case.
What I'm worried about. Are you telling me that the tax rate, give me two states that do that.
Nevada, Delaware, Alaska,
okay.
South Dakota.
All right.
It's become a big business.
Now, does that mean that person's wealth is protected from federal taxes?
No, it doesn't. It should not be, but it can be used to protect it from creditors, for example. And so states like Nevada have just a two-year look-back rule that, is being abused. I mean, the point is that there are also LLCs that are now available since the 90s. Practically, I think, 49 of the 50 states allow you to set up limited liability companies. So a place like Delaware, which we don't ordinarily think of as a tax haven, when I asked a leading attorney in Panama where he hides his money, he said, oh, I go to Delaware because there's no beneficial ownership registration. There's no, it's pretty good financial secrecy as a holding vehicle. We're not talking about the money actually going to Delaware, but he'll use that as an intermediate holding vehicle.
And what is Delaware doing with that money?
Well, they're making a big business in the corporate services area. They have 900,000 companies registered in Delaware. And so, this is just an example of where the onshore and offshore haven business is merging.
Richard Vaughn.
I want to go back just briefly to FATCA because it shows the unintended consequences of something that people thought would be a good idea. It's not only that U.S. citizens living abroad can no longer get many foreign bank accounts, but these foreign banks have ceased investing in the U.S., and we're going to see an increased capital flow out of the U.S., which will hurt us in jobs. And it's much more than a pain, because FATCA has both civil and criminal penalties on it, and it's also an impossible law for many foreign banks to comply with. Let's say with a bank in Austria, somebody walks in, they've got a Greek name, they speak Greek, they talk about a business they have in Greece, so they think they're opening an account for somebody who's Greek. But they don't know that person may also have a U.S. passport. In these days of dual citizenship, it's almost impossible for these financial institutions to know this with certainty, and to hold them criminally liable for things they cannot possibly know is very scary, and as a result, they cease investing in the U.S.
All right, let's go to Advance, Missouri. Good morning, Ryan.
Hi, Diane. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, sir. Go right ahead.
All righty. Well, my kind of statement question was, one guy said earlier that corporations are made up of, retirement investment people and all this. Well, I don't really think they're the ones that are capitalizing on this offshore investment. I think that the handful of the rich that he referred to are the ones that are capitalizing on it. But, if they spent less money trying to hire the politicians that would make the laws that make it possible and friendly for them to do this and use that money to pay their taxes, wouldn't that decrease the rate that was required to try to run a country?
James.
I think what you've seen is this, for the last 30 years, the growth of so-called tax competition around the world under the influence of this very powerful private banking and corporate lobby that's succeeded in creating a lot of the loopholes that Lee has talked about and I've mentioned as well. I think, you know, this is a vicious cycle where you have people who are basically not paying taxes, having excessive representation. You know, there are now, as we speak, about 1,825 registered lobbyists in Washington, D.C., just focusing on tax issues. And they're not working for ordinary Americans. They're working for the largest companies. It's not just true, by the way, that the pension funds and other, you know, nonprofit investors account for a majority of share ownership. Share ownership in this country is increasingly concentrated in the hands of the top 1% of the population.
Right.
That's why we've had wealth inequality.
Lee Shepherd, I have a question for you. Why were questions raised in Secretary the Treasury Liu's confirmation hearings about an investment in a venture capital fund based in the Cayman Islands?
We have allowed investment funds, that would be hedge funds, venture capital funds, private equity funds, to register themselves in the Cayman Islands. And my understanding is it's mostly so you can keep your investor list a secret while being run out of New York, Greenwich, Chicago, places in the United States. And U.S. law says, U.S. tax law says this, that, you know, the place where you're organized, you don't have to be run there, you don't have to have any people there, is where you are a tax resident. Now, if this thing has U.S. owners, then those U.S. owners have to pay tax on their investment income to the United States government. But when the managers of these funds are going all over the world looking for investors, some of the investors do not want to tell their own governments that they have this investment.
So what did Secretary Liu do, James?
Well, as I understand it, he had participated in one of these Cayman Island investments in a hedge fund.
And
he was also running, by the way, he was in charge for 2 years of Citibank's global private banking business. So some of us are concerned about how aggressive he's really going to be
about these
all of these issues that we're talking about.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's take a call from Portsmouth, Virginia. Good morning, Robert. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I'm believing, and if somebody can answer my question, that the banks have been stabbed when we witnessed the banking crisis go about. And now what we're seeing in Cyprus is the sure kill, because I think they're just trying to protect their jobs. And so they won't open the banks. They're keeping them closed. So their job will stay there, but they need to give everybody their money back and just go ahead and fall. Because the Book of Revelation says something about three kings will fall, seven will stand. These banks are kings.
All right. Thanks for your call. I think lots of folks are worried about the money and where it's going and whether small people, small investors are going to lose lots of money. Or is it just going to be the wealthy Russians, James?
I think that the Cyprus situation calls into focus, I think, the fact that, you know, taxpayers, in this case the EU taxpayers, are sick and tired of bailing out dodgy banks and lousy banking systems that are unregulated. This is partly the EU's fault. They should have put in banking regulation. But Cyprus, at the end of the day, is one of the smallest havens on the planet. We have 73 such havens on our list, and they're just number 20 in terms of secrecy and abuse of regulation. So, you know, there are a lot of other havens that are actually, this was a very good week for private bankers from Switzerland, from Singapore, from the UK, which also have very attractive laws from the standpoint of parking your money there.
But
and they have been going to Cyprus and recruiting those Russian deposits.
But with this latest news flash that the U.S. is going to take a much closer look at banks in Switzerland, including that in Liechtenstein, are we going to see more attention focused on exactly this problem? Richard Rahn, very briefly.
Well,
please.
We're going to see a lot more attention. But remember that you've got private banks in Switzerland have been around, some of them have been 200-300 years.
Right.
These are some of the safest banks in the world. And for people who want to preserve the money, I think the real lesson out of Cyprus is, first of all, you want to pay attention.
I've got to cut you short, please. Thank you. Richard Rahn. He's senior fellow at the Cato Institute, James Henry. He's an investigative journalist, author of the Tax Justice Network's report, The Price of Offshore Revisited, and Lee Shepherd, contributing editor at the journal Tax Notes. Thank you all so much. And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Ring.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from